You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
My name is Daniel Wolf. I'm the director of the Harm Reduction Program here at the Open Society Foundations, and I'm very glad to welcome you this evening to what will be a brief, moderated conversation, followed by questions, we hope, from you. Some of you who are following events at the UN may know that Anand Grover, who is the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, or on the right to everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health, presented a report yesterday that was probably the clearest statement that we have had within the UN system on the need to reframe drug policy and drug control measures. That report, I'm not sure if this was happy or unhappy, was preceded by a report on sexual education and health, which of course, as many of you who follow the UN know, took a lot of the heat and light. But we are very glad to have Anand here to talk with us about the report and some of the edgier implications of same. Anand has been the Special Rapporteur since 2008, but many of you may also know him because he has been a leading figure as the director and co-founder of the Lawyers Collective in India on a range of issues that touch on the intersection of health and rights. For those of us who work at OSI, we have admired his work both on access to essential medicines and challenges to the patent regime and the effort to make those medicines more accessible, and also groundbreaking work on the repeal of the sodomy prohibition. He is also, and the Lawyers Collective is less known for this, in international circles, but in small drug policy circles, is very well respected for some of their work on drug treatment and human rights, and their efforts currently ongoing to challenge detention in the name of treatment and often terrible abuses that occur while people are detained. His interlocutor is Joe Amen, who I think may be also familiar to many of you. He is the director of the Health and Human Rights Division at Human Rights Watch. When he joined the organization in 2005, he was the head of the HIV/AIDS program, which subsequently changed its name and broadened its mandate, but which also has done extraordinary work, most recently in Cambodia and China, documenting abuses in the name of drug detention, outlining some of the basic human rights issues that go to the heart of drug control and health, and taking on some of the sacred cows, including the UN system, the Global Fund, and the US government, that have often funded unthinkingly or uncritically some interventions that unfortunately are more abusive than helpful when it comes to drug use and people who are drug dependent. Joe is a member of the editorial board of the Journal of the International AIDS Society. He is a member of the UNAIDS Reference Group on HIV and Human Rights. He is a member of the Stop TB Program's Task Force on TB and Human Rights. He is an associate in the Department of Epidemiology at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, on and on. But he is also a very valued partner in our work and someone who is not known to shy away from the difficult question, even to his allies. So we're glad to have both of these folks here with us. So without further ado, I give the floor to Joe, actually, to ask the first question. And I think we'll probably go for about 20 or 25 minutes, if that's okay, and then open it up for you guys. But let's keep it short so that the audience can contribute.
Great. Thank you, Daniel. I just wanted to make one correction, which is we've changed our name again. We went from the HIV program to the health division, and now we're the Right to the Highest Attainable Standard of Physical and Mental Health Division at Human Rights Watch. But seriously, I am delighted to be here, and I'm glad that we've got a good crowd. I love being next to Anand because he's always blunt, entertaining, provocative. I sent him an email before this asking if there were specific questions that I could raise with him, and he said, "You can easily provoke me. You can put any question you want to me." So I want to start with that general question first, which is, Anand, is this the end of the war against drugs?
Absolutely not. I mean, I'm really happy you asked this question, because fortunately, after the presentation of the report and questions in the UN General Assembly yesterday, a lot of people came up to me and said, you know, where do we go from here? So I think it's a starting point within the UN system. It's been talked about by Open Society and Human Rights Watch, and I was just looking whether I'm guilty of plagiarizing your works.
But, we hope so.
Daniels and Open Society and Human Rights Watch did play a part in the inputting. Special rapporteurs are entitled to get inputs from various organizations. At the end of the day, it's my kind of baby, but there was very valuable inputs in the report. But for the UN, I think it's a starting point. But it will only be a starting point if we, in the outside, can pressurize the UN agencies as well as governmental agencies. But I think the UN agencies, which is more influential in trying to take this forward, is UNAIDS. And UNAIDS, we work together on the reference group. But I think we can actually now push this agenda with UNODC and the INCB. You know, we should try to do that. That then it would become a starting point, and it's obviously not the end of it.
Well, I mean, strategically, there are different ways to try and get UNAIDS and UNODC to push this. Where do you think the closest, the earliest wins are, and who or what are the obstacles to achieving those wins?
Well, I think, first of all, there's not been a real dialogue between people who are obviously the proponents of some of the things that we are talking about here in the report, including such things as harm reduction. So I think those are obviously now built into the UNAIDS program. But there's a lot of resistance within the UNODC against that. But there is a group within the UNODC, as you know, who are pushing that, and they want human rights to be taken up in a serious manner. So I think we should actually try to have a dialogue. So one of the suggestions I made is there is a need of an active dialogue amongst these agencies, and ultimately to have a commission which actually directs it. You know, these are two parallel kind of talking bodies and implementing bodies, and they just don't see eye to eye kind of thing. I don't know where the immediate victories are going to be, but obviously, you know, I think harm reduction is a major thing that we can really win very quickly on. But I think we have to go out and talk about the whole way sentencing is done, the whole way compulsory treatment is rolled out, and those things are longer term, because the places where they're happening, unfortunately, it's not only China and Vietnam and etc. In my own country, in India, it's done by NGOs. That's one of the cases that we are working on. And actually, if you look at death centers, in India we have mandatory death penalty for second convictions or commercial trafficking, which we have challenged, and that matter is coming up on the 23rd, which I'll be arguing. So there are lots of issues. So we are trying to, you know, strategically position ourselves in different places to attack the regimes as they exist. And there are ways of doing it. I think it's easy to win on certain things, difficult on other things. But each country and activist can decide what they should do. I don't use an overall prescription for it.
Let's talk about the difficult things. I mean, how do you think the message in your report about decriminalizing use of drugs is heard at the General Assembly? Where do you think...
I think there was a positive response, to be honest. And I was pleasantly surprised, because I thought there's going to be quite a lot of attack. Mm-hmm. But I was told by my assistants, we have two assistants attached to the rapporteurs in Geneva, who monitor what happens and strategically what's going to happen. So as Daniel said, my presentation of my report was preceded by the presentation of the rapporteur on the right to education. And his predecessor had prepared the report on the right to what he called, obviously sexual health education, and also the right to sexual happiness. Which was...
Can't have that.
So you can imagine the fireworks. And I have to tell you that there are entities in the states which get together, like the Organization of Islamic Conference, Organization of African Unity, the Arab group, this group.
They're against sexual happiness?
They're against for it to be made a universally recognized right. So... I think they are totally in favor of sexual happiness, but
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they are. They only want sexual happiness for themselves and not for other
they
nations.
Can't be. You can't go to court. I'm sorry. So I like the idea of somebody going to court. I want sexual happiness, and they get an order. But in any event, so this block was totally ballistic, as we say. It's an Indian expression.
Yeah, we have it.
You have it, okay? Must be from the U.S. They went ballistic against this report, and the steam was so heavy against this rapporteur. Then they took 2 hours instead of one, and I only had, 1 hour left for the whole session. And Manfred Novak was supposed to come after me. So I just shortened my report, thinking that if there is any attack, I stave it off. But actually what happened was that they lost the steam because I think they strategically decided to have all, ballistics against this rapporteur. And they didn't have anything against me. And those who spoke were the European Union, etc., etc. And they were all in my favor, So that was really good.
I guess there's two ways of interpreting that, though. One is that they lost steam and everyone agreed with you. And the other is that no one found that your recommendations were important enough to worry about because they had no intention of changing anything.
Well, I mean, you can look at it like that also. And I think you should because... let me give you another example. Last report in June, I presented on sex work and male-to-male sex and criminalization. I was attacked like Kishore Singh was attacked. And the same kind of comments were made that I was outside my mandate, etc. But what I did was I actually said I really welcome your criticism because it's the first time you're talking about this damn issue. Mm-hmm. So it totally took off the steam, from there. So I think it depends on how you relate. And I tried to make contact with the Egyptians, etc. to say, look, how do we take this forward? They may not agree with it. But at least now they think that I have a serious point of view which they need to consider. So that's one thing. The second thing is there are people who have supported us. I think it's important for the NGOs and activists to actually look for their support and actually give them precise particular policies and so that we can move forward. I think we should not lose the opportunity when they have come out explicitly in their statements in support or in... they want questions to be answered. Like, if there's a commission, what sort of a commission? If you want to depenalize or decriminalize, what sort of thing? What drugs? So I think if you give them answers, and these are not just empty kind of suggestions, they are based on what has happened. For example, Portugal, Mm-hmm. So I think there are people looking for this because it's become a problem now.
So what's the next step for you? What's the next step for other people to keep putting this issue on the table and getting progress made on it?
Yeah. Sorry, Joe, I just didn't answer your question. Decriminalization. I think internally people know it's not working anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they are looking for answers. So I just wanted to just add that.
Yeah.
I think we should now look at allies. And even, I don't know, in the US, I know there's been a bit of a debate about California and the Attorney General has spoken about it. But I think we need to advocate even here. More importantly, here, because this is the, the root of all problems in one sense. the war on drugs is started from here.
Yeah.
So it's very important to go to the lion's den kind of thing and say, look, this is an opportunity. Portugal has done it. Why don't we do it here? Because look at the results. Look at the evidence. Has anything bad happened? No. Has criminality increased? No. Have people got treatment? Yes. So you have all the positives. Why don't you do it? I think we need to articulate. We should not give up on anybody who we think can be changed and our stakeholders. We should just keep on trying. I think it's very important. But there are people who can take the movement further in Europe and Latin America. So I think there also we should have allies. We do have allies. There are judges, as we had a meeting in Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
There are judges who have held that it's unconstitutional in Argentina. So I think there are those areas we should really push. And then have dialogue when there are difficulties like in the U.S.
And what about for you? What's your next step following up on this issue? Are you going to do country visits or,
you get to ask Joe similar questions about his reports after this.
Okay. Country missions, this issue will come up wherever there's an issue. So if in a country, these are not disconnected as it were, but just for the audience, the rapporteur's work is country missions, two country missions a year, so six in a term, if it's extendable, if it's extended another 3 years, two country reports, so country missions cooked, and then two thematic reports like this one, and lots of complaints. It's a lot of work. It's basically 10 weeks. Now, I don't want to leave this or any other. Like, for example, on trips, the first report is still continuing. So there are lots of people all over the world who have started taking that issue up, and I go and talk about it. And in fact, on Thursday at, what is it called? I forget. American University, Sean Flynn's group, they are actually having the United States trade representative. So what I want to do is that wherever I go, if there is an issue, like say in Cambodia or Vietnam, I'll take it up. Now I'm going to Syria next time. I don't know whether that's a major issue there, you know. So if there's an issue like that, I'll take it up. So it'll reverberate in other reports also. Mm-hmm. But wherever I go, if there's a group working on that, I try to address it, take it up with the government. So it's an ongoing issue. And in the Lawyers Collective, we do this anyway as part of our work. Mm-hmm. So it's not, like I said, the mandatory death penalty under the Narcotics and Psychotropic Substances is challenged by us on constitutional grounds. And if we succeed on that, you know, we make inroads into death penalty in India, which is a major issue. So I think those are the things that I'll be doing immediately. But we have a very strong group within the Lawyers Collective which works on vulnerable groups, you know, on sex work, on LGBT issues, as well as drug use. So they are very keen on expanding that work across India and across South Asia and Southeast Asia. So these are the issues that we'll be taking up in terms of training, in terms of trying to articulate policies along with communities. It has to be based on community strength. NGOs themselves can't do it.
Yeah.
Lawyers Collective cannot do it. OSI itself cannot do it. It is only when what I say the abstract meets the experiential learning and they get together and fight.
Both Ban Ki-moon and Hillary Clinton are making a swing through Asia. What do you think the possibilities are that they'll hold up your report and hit the premier of Vietnam over the head with it, or the president of Cambodia?
Possibility is zero. I won't even talk about probabilities. But she might hold up a report which looks like mine. So, no, seriously, Ban Ki-moon has already made a statement. I think people like Hillary Clinton are the people to be approached, because there is some sense of rationality in their, in those type of people. And I think you are best situated and positioned to talk to people like that. Ban Ki-moon is quite clear, because he's made statements like this. And it's only that the briefing people must tell them at that particular time that this is an issue. You know, so it's raised. But I remember, I think you were in Cambodia, were you? When we had a meeting on this issue, the Cambodian officials were quite keen on taking this forward. Do you remember?
I remember. And then actually, they're revising their drug law this week. But unfortunately, there was a front page article in the Phnom Penh Post today, which actually Joe was quoted in, which noted, among other things, that they have decided to take the Vietnamese advice more seriously than the advice from you or the UN, and they will close all centers but one, but the one center will hold more people than all others combined and may be a forced labor center. So I think one of the questions for all of us, I mean, it's fine to say keep trying, but the problem is the health people speak to the health people, and what the health people give with one hand, the law enforcement people take away with the other. And, you know, you are the special rapporteur on health, but actually this is a law enforcement and public security issue as well.
Yes.
What purchase do you have, or what is there, what can be done about that split? Like, is there any way, do you have any forums to
bridge the
divide?
Well, in the UN system, two rapporteurs can actually get together and make a report, and that's the ideal thing. And that's what I've been
trying.
Are
we back to sexual happiness? Is that the
I would like it, but but I don't think it's a desire and wish or whatever, or a fantasy. But anyway, the point is that two rapporteurs can get together. But I think the UN agencies are also have tunnel visions. You know, they need to talk to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not only UNODC. There are other security agencies. They don't talk to each other. And this is what is required. And that issue has actually gone down well. Why aren't we actually having a holistic view about the whole thing? So I think that's where we need to talk. But I think in Vietnam and Cambodia, it's a long-term thing. It's not short-term. Because those societies function on a very different basis. They'd rather go with the ally like Vietnam it's happened there. You know, they know them very well, so they rather play safe as they think. Mm-hmm. It's not easy for them to just change over. So I think it's a long-term thing. We can't give up.
So before we open it up, just the bottom line is you think a drug-free world is unlikely?
I don't think we should have a drug-free world. No, I mean, that's a completely, let me put it, let me be very candid about it. And I did say this in the UN General Assembly yesterday when I got them to talk about it, and there was laughter. And, you know, it's quite amazing, actually, because always the stiff upper lip, you know. But yesterday they actually relaxed after the losing the steam over that other issue. And then I started to joke about it. And then and this is what I really believe in, this whole issue of drug control is a cultural issue, you know. In India, on one day, I was telling Daniel and Joseph and Joe that we have what is called the Mahashivratri. Traditionally in India, on that day, everybody has bunk. Now, my father-in-law, and I made this statement to the UN General Assembly yesterday. My father-in-law has bunk.
It's bung is cannabis
liquid, you know. It's a cannabis lassi or something. But I don't know how you describe it. It's actually a milkshake with cannabis in it.
Favorite reception afterwards. Well,
I think it's great. You know, what's wrong with it? But I'll tell you, so he loves it because he can have as many sweets afterwards because it's easy to digest it. So I told this to the UN General Assembly yesterday to tell them that, what about alcohol? Alcohol actually is deleterious to you, but it's regulated, it's not prohibited. Smoke is deleterious, and it's regulated, it's not prohibited. Why should cannabis be prohibited? It's because the West, when it colonized, they said, oh, well, alcohol was drunk at the table, you know, so we're going to have alcohol. But anything that you guys drink, we're not going to allow it. It's a cultural imposition of the Western culture. So, I mean, I think that actually went down well because they realized it's not so simple. So there's complete illogicality and irrationality in these regimes, apart from the fact that they just don't work, you know, and they actually create many problems, including deaths of people, which is why we don't want to have them. Apart from health, people are just dying, not only in Vietnam and Cambodia and China, but even in India where NGOs are running these centers. And that's a very sad thing. I mean, I didn't realize this in India until we started taking up the cases. And it's really sad that we were unable to do about anything about it for such a long time. You know, and I think it's really very important to change these things and get out there and say, if people are dying, how can we have this kind of thing? It's just not on anymore.
Okay. Now we open it up to you. We welcome questions on sexual happiness, bong, milkshakes, drug detention, drug control.
Sexual practices?
Anything. But please, I see many people in the audience who come at this issue from various angles, and many others that I don't know. So the floor is open.
My name's Jag Davies. I've worked in drug policy reform for various organizations over the past decade in the U.S., and at various points a little bit on international drug policy, but I've always been very surprised and dismayed that NGOs in the U.S. really mainly don't work on international issues. And I think, you know, generally when I speak with my colleagues about this, their sense is that, well, the media isn't interested in international drug policy, funders aren't as interested in international drug policy. What do you think we can do in the U.S.? And the sense generally is that, well, like you said, the U.S. started the problem, so we have to fix it in the U.S. first before we get to UN reform or international reform. What do you think can be done to stimulate organizations in the U.S. to prioritize international drug policy reform more?
Should we take 2-3 questions? Or?
Sure.
Let's take a few questions and then have a richer response. And while I'm going to invite Anand, I also invite other people in the audience and on the panel to engage the questions too if they feel like it.
Hi, my name is Tatiana Margolin, and I wanted to ask you about a recent complaint that has been sent to you from Russia. And it's generated a ton of enthusiasm on behalf of the harm reduction community and also a lot of media buzz in Russia, and I just wanted to get your assessment as to what do you think down the line the activists have to look forward to in terms of your recommendations for Russia, et cetera. So what are should they taper their expectations? They're very excited, et cetera.
Can you say a little bit about what the complaint was? Or?
Yeah. The complaint was filed on behalf of a female drug user who's been using since 83, who's been registered as a drug user since 1983 and has tried all sorts of treatments, has been in and out of prison, is HIV positive, hepatitis C, has hepatitis C, and is appealing to Mr. Grover by saying that the treatment available in Russia is not satisfactory to the disease that she has, and she is suing Russia for unavailability of opioid substitution treatment. And also just what I found very interesting from all the media coverage in Russia is that the media is not distinguishing that the complaint was filed to you as a special rapporteur. They're saying she's suing Russia in the UN, which I think actually is great because it makes it sound so much more grandiose. I just thought you should know that.
And just as a note to that, there was a big interview with her in a conservative but very widely read paper with a 2 million circulation, and it's, I think, the first time that a drug user has ever been portrayed in that newspaper as an agent of something rather than just as a victim or loser. Okay, other questions? Okay, well, let's start with those two, and then we'll...
Well, let me just start with Katerina, is it?
Tatiana.
Tatiana, okay, sorry, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay, sorry. And I speak a bit of Russian, but anyway, I'll just tell you about the procedure. I'm not entitled to talk about a complaint, because the procedure is such that when I get it, you can talk about it, huh? So you just say everything that you want to say, so it goes out. But I can't talk about it, because the idea is that the special rapporteur's mechanism for complaints or communications, they can be urgent or non-urgent, are supposed to get the complaints, and we are supposed to forward them to the state concerned through a particular procedure, and there's a protocol for that. And once it goes from my office, that is the Geneva office, to the Geneva office of the state concerned, in this case Russia, it is to be confidential. I cannot talk about it, because the idea is that the state must attend to the complaint. Now, a lot of the states don't really answer the complaint, but on the ground there are some changes made, which is good, you know. And I want people to talk about it themselves, though I can't talk about it. So I tell them, please talk about it, write that you've complained to the UN, etc., etc. Because at the end of the day, what happens is that Russia doesn't want complaints to be noticed in the UN. Nobody in the UN knows that Russia has a major problem, you know, on these issues. So the moment these are highlighted, they don't like it. Now, some countries are very good. They reply back, and they want to actually be very good lawyers, and they put on record that everything that the complainant is saying is incorrect, or rather I'm saying, like China and certain countries, they're very clear. They always reply. India, they have so many lawyers, they never reply. But it does actually make a difference on the ground. There are two studies done which actually make that point. They've just been released last month. So as far as I'm concerned, the complaint will be put into the process. I've already, you know, mentioned to Anya. Anya sent the complaint. So I'll be following it up. And actually, what happens is, and I'm not saying in the context only of Russia, but whenever there's a structural issue, like in the case of Russia, and I'm being diplomatic here because it's being recorded, then I would issue a public statement. Now, ideally, I want to do that in cases where there are structural issues. So if there are 2-3 complaints, then I would actually make a public statement, which the states hate. Okay? So if there is an issue, like I think there are issues around the world which warrant a public statement, it will come, you know. And there's a protocol for that also. You have to notify the state, you have to notify the press statement, so that the state has a chance to say, well, you know, what you're saying is rubbish, and then we issue the statement nevertheless. And then it goes into the press. Sometimes it is picked up by the press internationally, but it is definitely picked up by the local press. and that's what they don't like. So I just wait for times. I mean, I'm going to issue a statement in respect to the US also, sooner or later, and the EU, but I won't say anything about Russia right now.
And the second, or the first question, which was how to get the U.S. to care more about international.
I'm not the right person to answer that question, but I can only give ideas. I think there are lots of, there are U.S. NGOs working only on the international arena, not in the U.S. So I'm surprised that you're saying that. But I think the mix between the people who are working on drug issues and U.S. issues relating to drugs and international drug issues, they should actually combine together. I'm surprised that you're saying that, but I'm really not the right person to answer that question. I would really plead ignorance on how to go about it. I'm not one of the persons to speak on something that I do not have first-hand experience. I'm sorry, but that's my view.
Okay, other questions and or comments?
My name is Elena Vapnichna. I'm from UN Radio, so I know what you're talking about. We're following Rapporteur's reports to the General Assembly. You've been talking about UNODC, and I know that many people were unhappy with the new head of UNODC, who comes from Russia, infamous for problems with drugs and no substitution therapy, non-existent harm reduction program. So how optimistic are you that UNODC is going to be your ally? Sorry, I know it's very politically incorrect.
No, I think it's a very important question. But we'll take two or three because, or I mean, people can make comments also later, I think.
Yeah.
Any other questions then? Okay, then I'll answer that. Look, I'm an eternal optimist. I never have been a pessimist. You try to change the course of things, including people who are going to assume office, if you want to. And I know a lot of people did try to do it. But if you have that person who you think may not be your ally, you have to change tack and make sure that he understands or she understands what are the imperatives. And the imperatives today are not the imperatives which were there 10 years ago. In terms of drug control itself, I don't think you can actually run the UNODC in the same way you did 10 years ago. Even he has to face up to the fact that it is failed. I think that the realization is very important that the system has failed. And what are you going to do about it? And one of the things that you can remedy, even if you're the UNODC head, is to look at what should be done about the completely deleterious consequences that fall upon the people who are the victims of drug use or a drug dependent. They are being imprisoned, they are dying. What do you do about it? And one of the ways is human rights response and changing your laws. So I see it's a rational response, and I don't see why any head of the UNODC will not agree. Mr. Costa had his own view, and he did argue for a long time that if you legalized drugs, and that's how he put it, then the harms would be much more. I mean, we beg to differ on that. And I think there's a need to show that evidence is otherwise. But there was no dialogue, you know, and that was the problem. There was really no dialogue. And that's the failure of the UN system, that there should not be a dialogue. And please appreciate this. And this is a message I want even the UNODC had to understand. The whole objective of the Drug Control Convention is in the interest of public health, not drug control. It's public health. That's the primary objective, and that is the objective that has failed, because people are dying, they're actually getting ill. So according to me, the balance sheet is not in favor of the old system anymore. Therefore, you have to open your eyes. It's not a question of whether you're from Russia or from Czechoslovakia. I mean, US is no better, the whole thing has started from here. So if a US person would have come, we can't, nationalities are not the issue, I think. I think people have to be, you know, inside. I mean, you have to be self-critical. Nothing works. I mean, if you want to be diplomatic and political, it's one thing. I think when you assume a post, even as special rapporteur, I don't represent the lawyers collective or India. It's my duty now to speak out. Earlier I would have said, well, I'm not a special rapporteur, why the hell should I speak out of Russia? Today it's a duty to speak out. It's like that. I see it like that. So I'm an eternal optimist. I don't think there's anybody you cannot change, including Mr. Obama.
One of the things that was interesting in the discussion about the UNODC head is that our colleagues in Russia were actually significantly more optimistic than much of the international community, because they said, listen, we've had Mr. Costa and various Italians before him. Nothing has worked. Maybe it will take a Russian to tell Russia what the rest of the world is doing on drug treatment and drug policy.
Can I jump in with one question, Anand? One of the other aspects of the war on drugs and the impacts of the international drug control regime has been the limitation of access to legal opioids and pain relief medicines. Do you think there's momentum around that issue? Do you think that putting that issue into the discussion on drugs allows people to understand more clearly that there has to be this balance, there has to be this focus on health? Or do you think that it's a distraction?
Well, no, it's not a distraction. It's very central to the whole issue. But I don't think there's such a momentum that we would like to have on controlled medicines to be made available. And the victims are the developing countries, as you know, India included. I think there's much more work need to be done on that in terms of trying to change the regulations. But in India, I've had to face such a lot of problems in trying to change even little bits and things. And it's very complex set of regulations. I mean, to get the regulations and trying to change them, it's not an easy task. We need to actually get into that whole issue much more than even we have been. Mm-hmm. So, it's all easy to say change the regulations, but what regulations, how do they work, we haven't understood them that well. So, this is the stage of learning for us, and I think that's what we are actually planning to intervene in that issue in India. But internationally, I think there's much more work that needs to be done. There's not much momentum on it in that field, I think.
We have a few more questions, so please.
My name is El Sorilla. I work on access to medicines here at OSI. Of course, I'm happy to share your optimism, and you make a very strong case on decriminalization. But we're in a world context where criminalization is a strategy that we see in many different areas. We see criminalization of HIV transmission. We see it on sex work. We see it on access to medicines, as you know very well, on the whole criminalization of the infringement of intellectual property rights, which takes us like on a totally different level. But as you know, it's a very strong globalizing efforts where law enforcement indeed takes it over from the health sector, and where also, while we are talking to the health people around access to medicines, apparently we need to talk now with the law enforcement people, Interpol, the World Customs Organizations, and whatever. So how do you see that combined? On one hand, the decriminalization efforts that seem to take on, according to your optimism, some ground, but on other fields, a strong criminalization effort going on in globalizing?
Okay. Next.
That was quite a question. I'm Laura Thomas with the Drug Policy Alliance, and I would like to hear your thoughts on Portugal. Specifically, to what extent has Portugal actually succeeded at what they tried to do, and what has been the response within the UN and from other countries to Portugal, and what have been the barriers? Why are not other countries picking up the Portugal approach and running with it? What are the barriers? What are the reasons why it hasn't? And in fact, a larger question is, would the Portugal approach work? Would it work in a country like the US, for example, given that part of what I understanding is the success of the Portugal approach has been in vastly increasing their treatment capacity? And, you know, given the work, for example, that OSI has done, even on a small scale to try and expand capacity. I don't want to say small scale. It was large scale, but too small to address the true treatment need. What would it really take for the U.S. to adopt something like the Portugal model, and could it be successful here?
Well, okay. In terms of optimism, I think if you are in a battle to change things, you can never be pessimistic. That's one. That doesn't mean that you're not realistic. So you strategize to make sure that you get what you want. But you can never, ever lose your optimism because you believe in so many things which are important to you. I mean, I've been at it for the last 40 years now, and I've never lost hope. And because a lot of people, like those who are friends, like you here, you know, they give me a lot of energy. Communities give me a lot of energy. So in that sense, I always talk about optimism in that sense. It's not foolhardy optimism, realism. But I strongly believe that criminalization actually always has, whether it is in the sector of behavioral sciences or in any other sector, doesn't achieve its purpose ever. And I made a very bold and a bold statement once where I was ticked off because of course there are nuances. But as a general rule, I would say criminalization in the health sector and certainly in intellectual property, I mean even copyright and trademark, it's absolutely stupid, you know. It just doesn't work because it doesn't stop copyright piracy. I mean, the reason why piracy occurs is because of the differential pricing. And so I think decriminalization is a way forward, not only for that, but it also gives you a stand why it doesn't work and therefore you should oppose it. But of course, in intellectual property rights, border measures, etc., is a different angle. But the same yardstick also applies there. In terms of Portugal, I mean, there was a question like this before in another meeting. I mean, Portugal has shown, and remember, prior to Portugal, all the countries said that if we decriminalize or depenalize, then there'll be a large scale upscale, you know, the scale up of criminalization. That hasn't happened at all. That's very strong evidence to show that you can do it. It is coupled with treatment. I think that's very important because they look at it from the health standpoint. So it cannot be just decriminalization and nothing else. It has to be coupled with all the other facilities. And I don't see why it cannot happen in the US. Whenever the US is willing to change their laws and put into practice, they do it, like China. I mean, you know, it's very simple. If you have the political will, you can do it. But depends on whether you have the political will. And they need to change that political will if evidence is brought forth. I mean, I was happy when they changed the law relating to the limits of possession, which actually was the inequitous thing, but not sufficiently enough. And that's the problem I have with the U.S.
You mean when the U.S. changed?
Yeah. U.S. recent change, though. So I think it's possible. The European community, by the way, are looking at the Portuguese example very closely, and there's a lot of pressure around Europe to see what can be done about it.
For those who don't know, what Portugal essentially did was decriminalize possession of up to 10 days worth of drugs, including hard drugs. So this is the big distinction between, say, what other countries have thought about doing, and basically cut the criminal justice system out of the equation for people who were what they regarded as low-level offenders. So instead of going to the police, you went to something called a dissuasion commission, which would talk to you about your drug use and try to gauge whether you needed treatment, and if you did, to refer you to SAME, whether you didn't need treatment at all. But basically, anyone who had 10 days worth or less was not did not intersect with the criminal justice system. Please.
Hi, Brett Davidson from OSI. There's been a lot of talk about the evidence and about, you know, you talked about Hillary Clinton as someone who maybe has a bit more of a rational approach and so on. But what worries me is the rise of irrationality these days, particularly in U.S. politics. You know, we've seen it around this election. So how do you deal with that? I mean, what impact does evidence actually have? Do people actually listen to evidence? And if not, what kind of other approaches can you use? And maybe you have some insight from your experience in the year.
No. People don't listen only to evidence. I mean, if that were the case, everything would have changed a long time ago. It is to do with politics. It is to do with how you present issues. It's to do with life and death, you know. And all these issues are very much connected with life and death. And I think those things have to be brought emotionally closer to the people. If people in the USA find that, you know, their people are dying, I know they will say, well, you know, they deserve it or something like that. Somebody might say that because that's a society. If you are poor, you deserve it because you didn't do it the American way or what have you. But a lot of people do have, you know, emotional kind of reactions to issues which are posed in a particular way. If you just put it in cold evidentiary facts, it doesn't sell to people. So you have to have not only the cold evidence, but also the passion to deliver what you're saying with emotions. And that sells in lots of countries. That's my belief. I've seen people saying the same thing that I have said. It just doesn't sell. Because they don't believe in it. It's not passion, it's not just a trick. You must believe in what you're saying. And that, once it's conveyed, people say, okay, I think there's a need to consider it. It's just a very small example of what I'm trying to say. Politicians, when they change, they really change. Like in India, I have talked to a lot of politicians who have been close friends of mine because of they're at the bar, they're lawyers. So, you know, when you talk to them, they also say the same thing. You know, I have to make sure that I win an election. But once they won the election, for a period of time, they can look at things more rationally. But if everything is governed by elections, then there's a big problem. But you have to intervene in those debates. And I find that, of course, there is a lot of irrationality, as you say. But there is also rationality. It's not just irrationality. But it depends on how you can convince people. But I don't have the answers for the US, I must admit. I think you're from South Africa. And I don't think there's less irrationality in Tambo Mbeki's, so it happens all over the world. But I mean, you know, I think we should not. You have to devise new ways all the time to get your message across. I don't subscribe to pessimism at all. I mean, I encourage my colleagues to say, look, okay, yeah, you're right, there's difficulty, but let's think of, like a lawyer, when you are trying to argue a case, you may not win on one point. You'll have several points. You have to do it. Because if you're going there to win, that's the whole thing. You must go out there to win. There's no question of losing. But if you lose, you accept it. That's how a lawyer works. You know, you don't go out to lose. You have to win. But if you lose, you have to accept it. But at the same time, you always go with optimism to win. That's the philosophy of all lawyers. So.
Okay. Other questions? Elena, do you have another question, or are you just going back to your chair?
Going back, but okay. Actually,
she's too clever.
You were talking about the U.S., I guess, but I was busy with my equipment. Actually, in Russia, the U.S. is cited as an example, both by opponents and proponents of forced treatment. They say, look, in the U.S., people have an option. You go to jail or you go to treatment. You know, those who are with the forced treatment, they say, well, this is your forced treatment. And, you know, here's the U.S., you know, the democratic country, you know. And then the other side says, you see how, you know, what good life is for drug users in the U.S. They can have a choice, you know, to have treatment instead of going to jail. So what's wrong with the U.S. then?
Well, I mean, I think it's based on insufficient information about the U.S. because if you look at the rate of incarceration of drug users in the U.S. and the morbidity amongst them, then you realize it's one of the worst systems that's operating. So there are better systems, and I think rational understanding of that will show you that there are better practices, including Portugal, which would actually indicate that the U.S. is not an example to follow. But obviously, you know, in a country like Russia, I haven't been there, so I can't really say from the inside. I know a lot of people, and I've always had affinity towards the history, culture, etc. But, you know, America is seen in the Eastern European sector as one of the ways to go forward. But that's a myth. You know, like in India, we say now all the diseases of the American economy are being exported to India, like insurance system. So we know what's bad and what's good. But not everybody knows that. If you don't come to the U.S., you won't know. If you don't study, you won't know. So there are all these myths. I mean, we have to apply, you know, we have to study, we have to apply rational criteria to decide. Sorry.
Hi, Daniel Raymond from the Harm Reduction Coalition. My question is about strategy or maybe sequencing, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are about whether there's the political space to really have a discussion about decriminalization in countries which retain especially punitive policies around compulsory detention or regressive approaches resistance to harm reduction. Is there a certain sort of threshold in kind of blunting the extremes of the criminalization approach that needs to be reached before there's a political space to open up to talk about decriminalization?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I'm sorry to say the political space is dwindling, because HIV was a big space, and HIV is actually, you know, the incidence of HIV is coming down in Asia. We're losing that space, and that's the problem. So
I hate it when that happens.
Well, you remind me of a friend of mine who's a director of environment health in the WHO. She told me that she was a leprosy mission head or something in the WHO. And when she started talking about treatment of leprosy, there were these Christian groups who believed that leprosy had been visited upon those persons or victims of it because of the God's wrath. They were opposed to treatment altogether, you know, and there was a big fight. But, you know, there is space within HIV. HIV is, according to me, a space. So therefore, you can talk of harm reduction. And we used it very effectively. You know, HIV was the biggest space for so many issues. Nobody wanted to talk about harm reduction. They don't want to talk about men having sex with men and drug users, nothing. That is a space still open. How long will it be open? We don't know. But in Asia and Central Asia and Eastern Europe, it's the injecting drug users which are actually, you know, fueling the epidemic. So I think that space will exist for some time. So sequentially, like I was telling Joe, it's that area, harm reduction, which is an entry point for us. If you start talking about compulsory treatment, it won't happen immediately. You have to raise the issue. But in order to change policies, I mean, the UNAIDS is very clear that you have to. And the Global Fund is a sort of a, you know, you can use that to twist their arm. And that's what's happening a bit now. I mean, there was an issue there, whether you are funding, you know, treatment centers which are not complying with human rights norms. But I think that's the space. We should work on that.
If I can just add, I think there's a couple of things in this question also about change. And one is the model. And, you know, having Portugal is useful, but or having California is useful, but everyone's going to sort of say it's a little bit extreme or unique. Or having more models in more parts of the world so that there's a local model that people can really look at. The flip side of that is having the extreme cases be more isolated. You know, and so it's going to take a lot, perhaps, to change China's approach to drug control. You know, but moving it into a more isolated situation where they can't say, well, we're doing the same things, or, you know, Vietnam or Laos or Cambodia can't say, well, we're doing the same things as all of these countries, you know, allows there to be more attention paid to that. And in the fights over changing HIV travel bans, you know, one of the useful things was talking about U.S. in a group of five countries that had an absolute ban on people living with HIV from entering the country. So, you know, if we can get to a dialogue where we can talk about the five worst countries in terms of their drug policies and show just, you know, how extreme that group is, it puts much more pressure on them to see that they're out of line and out of step. But we're still, you know, many steps away from that.
And just one other addition to that is that decriminalization is a complicated term because Vietnam, for example, has decriminalized drug use even as it interns 50,000 people in forced labor camps where people are forced to work in the service of private companies. So it's very funny to go to Vietnam and they say, well, it's fantastic, we decriminalized, and then you talk to the drug users who say that, you know, the neighbors can report you, you are forcibly tested by the police, and if you... your urine test positive, you're put away for up to 5 years in education. Please.
Hello, I'm Jari Chevalier, and I'm an artist and writer and host producer of the Living Hero podcast. So I first apologize for arriving late, and I'm not sure if my question fits with the scope of the evening, but I recently read The Globalization of Addiction by Bruce Alexander, a Canadian researcher, and I wonder if any of you have read it or are familiar with it. Well, his central thesis is that free market capitalism, which is you know, globalizing very rapidly is actually responsible for the rise of addiction worldwide. And so my question is, what do you think of this thesis? And the second part of it is, if there's truth in this, what's to be done about that as part of all the work that you're doing?
Can you say a little bit more about the mechanism by which the free market would be responsible? I don't know what I think of it, but it would help. I didn't read the book.
Yeah, I haven't read the book.
Okay, you can add to this, but just that it breaks up communities, it forces this extreme individualism, and it breaks up the human dynamics that give people the emotional support to not turn to addiction, not just, not substance addictions only, but the many, many forms that addiction takes, as many as we can think of.
Well, without having read the book, I would not be able to, make a sort of a comment on the particular thesis that you're talking about. But it seems to me that it's very simplistic to draw a causal relationship between what is termed as free market capitalism. There isn't such a thing anymore. That's long time ago, laissez-faire. Today it's monopoly capitalism, in Marxist terms, if you want to call it. And there is protected monopolistic kind of markets, either through law, like intellectual property rights, or cartelization, because companies agree to do certain things. So it's not free market at all. Yeah. The other thing is how capitalism over historical periods disrupted existing societies and therefore, atomized individuals, which is the cause of the addiction. I think it's an attractive idea, but I don't know the evidence that's put forth. I mean, it's very attractive to think of it. Look, I'm lonely, therefore I take drugs. It wasn't like that in the old days. It was a cultural ritual,
It's a very big book.
Mm. Yeah, of course. So I'm not making a comment on that, because it's not for me to make a comment on something I've not read. But I'm saying, I remember a lot of ideas like that floating around in the 60s and 70s. But, they're not there anymore. But I don't know. I won't be able to comment on it just like that. But, individualization, atomization of individuals, whether that is the causative factor for people being addicted, let's say, to television or to, it could be music also. Would you call music an addiction? So that's the whole, the categories, addiction, is it an obsession? So it's a very difficult thing to really measure, I think.
When it becomes unhealthy for the person, but they can't stop.
Well, music, that's a good example. I'm just deliberately being provocative, because I think addiction is not easy to define. Like a person who is in yoga, in nirvana, he or she may be addicted to it, because they can't, can they help themselves? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. So it's a very difficult issue. But I think it deserves a read, as you mentioned it. So I'm interested in it. But I don't know whether the thesis is...
I can't represent the book.
No, of course not.
But I do recommend
it. No, I would love to read it. I hope it's readable, huh?
Okay, well, we hope you'll come back next year and report on that and other things.
the right to addiction.
I'm going to give the last word to Joe, and then I hope you'll all stay for some refreshments, because we have some at the back and some informal conversation. So, Joe.
Well, first let me just say thank you to all of you for coming, and also to Anand and to Daniel for moderating so well. But I think this issue... we've really touched upon a lot of aspects of it in terms of how the right to health is realized and how governments trample upon that right in different ways around the issue of the war against drugs. I think the last note is one we could have an entire another session on in terms of addiction and what is addiction. And in many, many cases, what the work that we're doing is the response is really this panic, this moral panic about drugs. And it's wrapped up into words like addiction that aren't well defined, that aren't clearly supported. And discussions like this and bringing into the General Assembly a discussion about drugs and about human rights, I think, is the first step towards breaking down some of that knee-jerk reaction and that panic reaction. And I think one of the important real barriers to progress also is thinking that there's a silver bullet and a simple solution to deeply embedded cultural or you know other types of issues that are around and surround the issue of drug use. And I think your report, Anand, does a really nice job of questioning that and starting to put in place a framework in which people can discuss how a more complicated understanding can be made of this issue and how very simple steps can be taken to start to address the harms that come about both from drug use and from the response to drug use. So I thank you, and
thank you.
I look forward to this being just the first of a conversation and an advocacy push. And sort of feel like we need to end on an upbeat note, so like, you know, la lucha continua.
Thank you all, and please help yourself to refreshments.